Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Wednesday, April 23rd, 2025. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the first three episodes of Andor Season 2, and we'll present an interview with showrunner Tony Gilroy and actress Genevieve O'Reilly. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer Jeremy Mathai.
Hey, folks. Thanks for having me.
Jeremy, how are you?
I'm doing well, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. Andor Season 2 is here. You and I were huge, huge fans of the first season of the show. You have a full review of Andor up at slashfilm.com. I'm going to link to that in the show notes so people can get your full thoughts directly. But give them the gist. Give people your reaction to Andor Season 2 overall in kind of a non-spoilery way, and then maybe we'll drill down on some details in the first three episodes.
Yeah, the non-spoilery part is a little tricky because, like, after watching all 12 episodes ahead of time, which in and of itself is like one of Lucasfilm's probably biggest shows of confidence, of just like they knew exactly what they had on their hands with this. And honestly, that couldn't have been more true. It is just as good as season one, if not even better in many aspects, in my opinion. It just blew me away. This is just an epic, sweeping, revolutionary tale about the most unlikeliest of characters. Like, I don't know about you, Ben. I watched Rogue One when I first watched it back in, what was it, 2016. And I didn't really feel like any of the characters kind of like stood out that much, except for maybe Andor, just kind of like hiding out in the background. I feel like there's some untapped potential there. And somehow, miracle upon miracle, they decided to drill down on this one character for this show. And I'm still amazed that it turned out to be this well done. Tony Gilroy has the juice, as the kids would say. I think he just figured out exactly what was ticking at the heart of this character that made him so special. And just getting the canvas, that kind of blank slate, to just redefine it however he wanted it to be. Andor is just one of the, and it's not even just Andor either. He's a compelling character on his own, as season one proved, but season two really drills down on just the cast of characters, the really, really deep bench of characters that he has. You have Dedra Miro, you know, on the Imperial side of things, and Cyril, and their like unlikely story this season, the first three episodes. You have Luthen Rael, and he's kind of just like this shadowy figure and the rebel leader who doesn't get the credit for what he deserves, honestly, is like kind of the leader behind everything that we see in the original trilogy. This is the guy responsible for it. And just seeing how this show explores that aspect of these things, of these unsung heroes, in a way that the movies never could, it gets me on fire. This show is operating on all cylinders, and I can't recommend it enough. Like, fans,
yeah.
They watch the first three episodes, you're in for a wild ride this season, trust me.
I would say, just broadly speaking about the season as a whole, I felt a little bit of a narrative constriction as it gets toward the end, because we know that this show has to funnel directly into Rogue One. So the narrative possibilities of what can happen to these characters become tighter and tighter, and they have to effectively get on rails in order to just feed into the narrative that we know is coming. It's the kind of prequelitis thing. And I didn't feel that quite as much in the first season of Andor, because they started so much further back on the timeline. And so by introducing all these other characters and like having Cassian be this guy who's effectively not even the same person as he will be by the time we get to Rogue One, it felt like the canvas was a little wider to me in season one. And as season two goes along, it just kind of feels like it slowly narrows the focus a little bit to get everybody on those rails I mentioned. But still, like, as a two season project, Andor is like unparalleled in terms of quality when it comes to Star Wars TV shows. I personally enjoy it more than all but maybe two or three of the movies as well. And I mean, in general, I just think it's like so smart, so resonant. And George Lucas has said again and again that Star Wars is for 12-year-olds, right? And I think Tony Gilroy came along and made a show that is specifically not for 12-year-olds. It's a show that feels like it was made by adults who were trying to use it to speak to other adults and reflect real world ideas to us through like the prism of this iconography that we've all grown up with. It's just a really incredible piece of storytelling, you know?
I think that's what makes it special too. You can have this story about, you know, it is a darker story. It's a more mature story. It's definitely for adults more than any other property in this entire series, but you know, it can coexist alongside, you know, The Mandalorian and stuff. Like the Star Wars is big enough that it can kind of take all these tones and put it into one world. And I think that's kind of what makes it special.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot to love in these first three episodes, which are streaming on Disney Plus right now. And I just wanted to know what plot lines or character arcs or aspects of the show stood out to you in the early going here, Jeremy.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, fans were kind of left on the season one finale. Andor just accepted, you know, he kind of forced his way into either, okay, either kill me or take me into the rebellion. And this, the premiere takes, you know, it takes place in a year later, and he's already, he seems like such like a veteran already of the rebellion. He's this like, he's suave. He's this almost debonair James Bond figure in the opening moment, which is just such a great touch. And then like the way that gets undercut in the first action sequence, when he clearly has absolutely no idea how to fly this TIE fighter that he is not prepared for whatsoever. And it's just almost this slapstick kind of humor, which really took me off guard. But yeah, between after, you know, the Andor's storyline, there's also like the wedding with Mon Mothma. And that's a character that I never really thought I would ever be emotionally invested in. And this season dedicates episodes 1-3, a large chunk of episodes 1-3, to this like family wedding where she's just put under this like pressure cooker on all sides. And it's just fascinating, fascinating stuff. And then there's that boardroom scene between all the Imperial officers, probably about halfway through the premiere episode, where they're just casually talking about how to commit genocide on this planet-wide scale in the most casual overtones possible. Gilroy is obviously like kind of pulling from actual, you know, World War II history here. This is literally what the Nazis did when they were planning the Final Solution too. And it's just the way that he just, like, this is the kind of thing that only Andor can do, right? I don't think I've ever seen an extended sequence like this that just confronts like the brutality, the authoritarianism of the Empire in such like matter-of-fact ways. So that's like one of the early strengths of the show already. I love it.
Yeah, and like weaponizing communication too, the whole like Ministry of Enlightenment thing, which is just horrifying. And like, you've never really seen, you've maybe seen the after effects of some of these conversations, but this show shows you the conversations that lead to the policies and the decisions and stuff like that, which is like, again, you would maybe think that kind of stuff could be boring, but it's actually in some ways scarier than the actual consequences of it because of the tone of the and then like the tenor of the conversation, like you're talking about, like just the matter of fact nature. You've got Orson Krennic, you've got Ben Mendelsohn back as that character, and just him just kind of being annoyed at, like, you know, he's got this Death Star project that he's working on the side, as we know from Rogue One. And he's just kind of like, all right, now I'm being tasked with this. I got to figure this problem out. And it just kind of feels like he wants to be somewhere else, but he's talking about slaughtering an entire population as just like, you know, this is the lunch meeting meeting that I have before lunch on a certain day, you know? So, it's kind of terrifying in that way. You mentioned Cyril and Dedra having a little bit of a different dynamic in this season. And I was kind of surprised to see them as a couple, because in season, I did not rewatch Andor before season one, before diving into season two. But in my memory, Cyril was just this kind of like sniveling weasel who was obsessed with Dedra, and she kind of wanted nothing to do with him. But I guess some time has passed and she's changed her tune a little bit. So what did you make of those two?
Yeah, when I did rewatch season one in the lead up before this, and I did kind of pick up, at least in the finale, even before the finale, when Cyril is first kind of brought into the office by Dedra in one of the later episodes of season one, he's just like, you can kind of see it on his face, like this lifelong Imperial devotee is just like, not, he's over the moon as soon as Dedra walks into the room, and he's kind of obsessed with her. I wouldn't call it, you know, it's not really a true, authentic, romantic relationship, I don't think. I think they're both kind of getting what they kind of need from each other in a very, you know, it's kind of a fucked up way, I'll admit. But yeah, I think what that time jump does is it kind of gives the opportunity for both of them to kind of explore that dynamic a little more, how their relationship kind of, you know, it's more about the fascism of the empire than anything else. It's about how these people, they are people first and foremost, but they are looking for something a little more structured, a little more kind of evil in that sense, where they're just, it's fascinating to watch, I think. Once you kind of get over that initial jarring of like, oh, they're a couple now. This is kind of, you know, trust me, where fans see that where this goes from now, it's worth the surprise, I think.
Yeah. And so you mentioned the show. I mean, I think the first season, it was pretty focused on the fascist overtones as well. And I think that is, incredibly effectively communicated in the subplot in the first three episodes of Andor, where Star Wars fans are going to yell at me because I don't know the name of the wheat planet where we catch up with Bix and Willman and that other dude who was one of Cassian's friends back in season one. But I thought that whole subplot was just, yeah, really, like, the term enjoyable to watch is kind of wrong to say when we're talking about something that features an attempted rape scene and a too close to home allegory about persecuted immigrants. But hopefully you know what I mean. So, yeah, what did you make of that subplot?
Yeah, I actually, this is a big part of a piece that I recently wrote for Slash Film. I think it just went up, actually. It's about how these first three episodes kind of depict the Empire in ways that we've never seen in Star Wars before. It's just showing that kind of banality of evil just like right there in your face, as straightforward really as it gets. And this particular subplot, I think, you know, it's not even trying to be subtle in classic Star Wars fashion. They literally say these are, you know, Bix, Brasso, Willman, I think, is the other rebel who's with them from Ferrix in season one. They're literally undocumented workers. They're here just hiding out from the Empire, trying to keep a low profile. And it's just the way that Imperial Lieutenant Kroll, I think is his name, just the way he even admits that, like, yes, this planet does need undocumented labor in order to, you know, to continue doing its manufacturing and all that. But he's kind of aware that, like, trying to document every single person, trying to make sure all the paperwork is intact, is kind of a pointless job, but it's what he has to do. And he knows that, like, he can get what he wants by abusing Bix the way he tries to do. And it is just, it is really some of the most harrowing, disturbing material I've ever seen in Star Wars. And I kind of, you know, it's not my place as a guy to say whether this, you know, this sort of sequence is what's needed in Star Wars or not, or in media in general. But I do applaud Gilroy for going there. It's horrible to watch. But I think it's kind of necessary. And I think fans are going through those complicated emotions right now, where they're trying to decide whether is this Star Wars or not. And I think that's a fascinating conversation to have.
Yeah, totally. So in terms of the one subplot I think that I was most annoyed by in these first three episodes, the Cassian being held prisoner subplot, that's where everything is revealed to be taking place on Yavin 4, the planet that eventually becomes the crucial home base of the rebellion. We talked about this on Slack a little bit, so we're sort of recycling this conversation a little bit. But I understand that Gilroy and the storytellers are trying to indicate that rebellions are difficult and there's infighting and splintered alliances even within a larger movement. But to me, it felt like Gilroy is normally way more artful at weaving modern day parallels into this show. He's typically able to work larger ideas into the show in a way that remains entertaining. But for me, that subplot was really tough because all the characters are miserable. The dialogue is not as electric as it is elsewhere in the series. And the momentum of the story just ground to a halt just when we were supposed to be getting back in the saddle with Cassian after the show being off the air for years. And you mentioned, like, that opening stretch with Cassian and, like, him being all suave and Bond-esque and then kind of, like, bumbling his way out of that hangar or wherever the ship is stored, right? And so I was kind of like, okay, this show is like having a little bit of fun with the return of this character, reintroducing us to this character. And now he's blasting off out of there and we're all locked and loaded and ready to go. Like, let's get this season moving. And then it just kind of feels like everything just grinds to a halt when he's captured on that planet or held prisoner or whatever. So I know I was really bothered by that, but in our conversation earlier off mic, Jeremy, it seemed like you weren't as bothered by that. But yeah, can you tell me about your reaction to that part of the show?
Yeah. In the moment, I kind of enjoyed what Gilroy was doing with this, even though in retrospect, I'm going to do that obnoxious thing where I say that I have seen the whole season, of course, but like in retrospect, I think it is the weakest, probably the weakest subplot of the entire season, precisely for the reasons that you say. The pacing kind of grinds to a halt. It's not as energetic as the rest of the season is, or even how that opening sequence started. But I do think there is something worthwhile there about just how this show, you know, continues to get in the mud about all these details of how, yeah, you can have people who call themselves part of the rebellion, or the nascent rebellion as it was, the rebellion to be, and they just can't get out of their own ways. They're infighting. They're going against each other rather than teaming up and, you know, doing the obvious thing and teaming up and finding a way out. And it's so relevant to where we are now politically. I don't think I'm saying anything out of turn here when I say it kind of feels like how Democrats kind of turned on each other as soon as Trump won the election again last year, instead of, you know, kind of coming together and being like, okay, this horrible thing happened. How do we, you know, move forward together from this point on now? And obviously this was written, you know, well ahead of time. So I don't think that was as overtly intentional as probably the way I'm reading it, but there is something there, I think, that kind of taps into something real too.
Yeah. So you mentioned Mon Mothma's daughter's marriage subplot, and I know this part of the show really spoke to you, and especially like the production design and like the just the way that whole thing comes to a head and like ends on that scene where she's just like dancing the night away and kind of like I thought that scene where she speaks to her daughter right before the ceremony begins, and it seems like she's trying to connect with her on this human level and like bringing her own history into it. And then her daughter basically like rejects her to her face and is like,
"Oh my God,
read the room, mom. What are you talking about?" Basically, was just like so gutting, and just a really incredible moment for that Mon Mothma character. So yeah. Anything else you wanted to say about that plot line or like the aesthetics of that part of the show or anything like that?
Yeah, I think Mon Mothma is just such that she's the quintessential example of that Star Wars thing where fans gravitate towards like these unlikeliest, most unexpected characters ever who don't really get that much screen time in the original trilogy at all. Like she has maybe a couple big scenes in Return of the Jedi, if that, and she became a sensation with fans. She became a fan favorite or whatever. I feel like Andor is the first time we're actually seeing, you know, the actual interesting story behind that character. And that's what Gilroy does so well. He treats these, you know, iconic members of the franchise as just human beings. And I think it seems so obvious to say out loud, but that's really the difference of what sets characters like her apart in this show than we've seen even in Rogue One, where she gets kind of a bigger spotlight. And yes, like, I can't believe how it happened, but yes, I am fully invested in like, this privileged senator from generational wealth who's, you know, has to wear those masks. She's pretending to be an ineffectual politician to the public at the same time that she's secretly funding a rebellion. And at the same time, kind of dealing with her estranged family dynamic from a husband and a daughter who really, like, they can't stand her. She can't stand them, but she loves them all the same. And there's just something so three-dimensional and human about that makes you know, and obviously the way that O'Reilly plays it, that there's just something so human about it and so fascinating. And yeah, that subplot is probably one of my favorites in the season, and I can't wait to see where it goes. I can't wait for fans to see where it goes. I mean,
awesome. Okay, so let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
When it comes to fungicides, there's only one way to spell yield: N-E-O. Miravis Neo is the 2024 number one retailer recommended corn fungicide for a reason. It dominates spots, rots, blights, and stress to outyield competitive brands like Veltima. And there's 6 years of university data to prove it. Ask your Syngenta retailer about using Miravis Neo for more yield more often.
Based on 2024 Stratus retailer efficacy study. Always read and follow label instructions.
Okay, so we are now going to transition into your interview, Jeremy, with Tony Gilroy and Genevieve O'Reilly, who plays Mon Mothma. Anything you wanted to say in terms of setup for this conversation?
Yeah, I've obviously made it no secret on this podcast already, but how much of a big fan I am of her and her performance specifically on the show. So I was glad to be able to talk to both her and Tony Gilroy together, and just the way that, you know, she has to... The kind of the mental grind that I feel like it would have to take on a performer to have to play a character who can never be fully honest and straightforward and direct. like pretty much everybody else is in this show. And then obviously I put on my biggest investigative journalism hat later in the interview, and I had Gilroy address the most important topic of all, which is that incredible disco droid that makes an appearance during the wedding reception, and everyone's kind of dancing out to this EDM music that's blasting. And it's just, it's a fascinating, fascinating part of the show that I didn't expect to ever see. And I'm glad that I had the chance to talk to these guys about it.
Awesome. Okay, here is Jeremy's interview with Tony Gilroy and Genevieve O'Reilly.
So I'm so glad I got to talk to you both together like this. I remember when the first trailer for season two dropped, my first reaction in our work chat to the Slash Film team was, I can't believe this show got me emotionally invested in Mon Mothma, of all characters. And I mean that in the highest compliment possible. It's my go-to example of everything this show does so well. It takes these pillars of the franchise, all this iconography, and kind of brings them back down to earth in the best possible way. Tony, is that the kind of reaction you're looking for, in, you know, from both casual viewers and diehard Star Wars fans alike for this upcoming season?
Totally. If you were me, that's exactly what you want. Yeah. What do I want? I want connection. I want to break your heart. I want you to feel that you understand these people. I want you to be asking questions. What would I do? It's all the identity. I mean, yeah, I want everything. I want it all. Yeah, absolutely. The answer is yes.
Genevieve, I can't even imagine what a whirlwind journey this has been for you, going from episode 3 to your grand return in Rogue One. And now you're kind of almost headlining the show with, you know, some of the greatest moments of this entire show so far, I would say. What going into season two, what unexplored aspects of Mon Mothma's character did you still feel like we needed to learn more about?
Well, first of all, I think I need to say, it doesn't feel like a whirlwind. It feels like it's been a really, you know, it's a hike up a mountain. But I think Andor helps me as an actor really feel like we've reached the summit with this character. I feel so grateful for the story space, the character development, the interest in this woman that Tony and the writing team have allowed for and written for, not just for me as an actor, but for her as a character. You know, I feel at the end of this season, you know, I understand, like, it's not just a pillar or a skeleton. We've got muscles and sinew and texture and blood and heartbeat. And I really understand the rhythm of this woman and the way that we didn't really examine before.
Just the marriage alone, just the pairing of it all.
Yeah.
I mean, if people left it the first season, then they're like, oh, this guy is this. But it's so much more complicated, isn't it, their relationship?
And to sort of follow up on that, how much personal input, Genevieve, did you have in kind of crafting this character along with Tony in terms of whether it was individual scenes or even like her overall arc this season?
No, I think Tony and his team do all the heavy lifting. They do all the work. Us as actors receive it when it's pretty pristine. Like, the piece is very beautifully detailed. Tony is an instinctively collaborative person. He's a high communicator. So he would ring, and after the scripts, or actually even in the middle of seasons, and we would talk about things, ideas, and he would really allow for me to be able to say, hang on a second, what about that? Or what about that? And it was great. I mean, it's not, we don't, once we arrive on set, we have a finished, beautifully architectured piece. And that allows for a freedom of performance, actually, because no one's complaining or trying to whittle something down. There's a real freedom in understanding that we all have a shared piece to work from. So I think the work comes before that. He's curious about character, so he's interested in our perspectives.
Now, Tony, I'm so curious about your experience, you know, these last 5 years working on this show as long as you have, and how it compares to other studio projects that you've been on before. Did you feel like you had sort of like free rein to kind of redefine the backstories of established characters like Mon Mothma, or even with other characters, kind of inventing it from whole cloth?
Yeah, in my entire career, even as a Final Cut director, I've never had the freedom that we've had on this. I mean, I mean, we literally, I know it's hard for people to understand, but we were given complete creative freedom all the way through. Everybody knows we changed one line for Fiona Shaw we've had plenty of conversations that have had creative impact about economics. There are things that we can't afford to do, things that are too complicated, things that have been interrupted by COVID or by strikes, things have been affected. So there are conversations and problem solving. But my personal experience is I sort of feel like for my whole career, as I was a short story writer, and I've been offered the chance to be a novelist. And not just a novelist, but like, okay, go write an epic novel. You know, and that if you're asking me how it feels to me, that's the difference. You live in a sort of 130-page ghetto your whole life, and then all of a sudden you have 1,500 pages and this huge canvas and this huge topic. And so that the liberating aspects of that and the liberating aspects of the freedom that and the confidence that Disney and Lucasfilm put in us, that's how we got here.
Now, Genevieve, what draws me to your performance the most, I think, is how it's just the way you play this character of having to have all these constant masks on, you know, in her day-to-day life, both in public and in private. And I'm just watching this and imagining the kind of toll that takes. You and Stellan, especially, it feels like, okay, here you have actors playing characters who are putting on performances as well. And that the extra layer, it feels like to me, it's incredibly compelling. And it also just feels mentally exhausting. Was that your experience working, you know, from a performance point of view?
I mean, that's the dream as an actor, to be able to get to play many facets of character and to hopefully maybe achieve some of that within a moment. I mean, it's kind of fine, detailed work that you hope to be given the opportunity to do. But she, as a character, she can only be successful if she maintains that. And so what's great is to hear you say that you understand the... perhaps what that is to carry, you know, emotionally, what that, how under fire that woman is at any given moment, and that risk of exposure.
I think her journey is the most difficult one in the whole show because she has to do everything under glass. Everything is being observed. I remember in the very beginning when you said you were jealous of Faye, of Vel, she gets to go out and shoot guns and do all this stuff and jump off cliffs. And there's a physical outpouring. She has none of that. She can't do anything. She has to just be constantly not screaming out loud. Yeah. No, I think it's a very difficult path.
And now, it's really great within the relationship that Tony's created to have those scenes with Luthen, because then you see how both of those kind of multidimensional characters really have to cross and bang up against each other.
Now, this interview won't be published until after the first three episodes drop, so I'm going to get into a little specific question here.
Okay.
One thing I've, you know, this entire wedding arc stretched over these first three episodes is just incredible. It feels bold. It feels risky. But there's one thing in particular I have to ask you guys about, and it's the disco droid. That entire that entire dance sequence, just in terms of the disco droid, who thought of that? What inspired that? Was it a practical effect? And literally, you know, anything else you could tell me about that would be great.
The song is Niamos. So Niamos came up the first time when we went in season one, when we went to Niamos. So we really liked that song a lot. And then it's very difficult to do source music in the show. So Nick took that Niamos theme, and if you listen very carefully, it's back in the brothel in the very beginning, played weirdly. It's also in the embassy, played sort of backwards. So we sort of said, what if it's a galactic hit? You know, like, what if that's a really big galactic hit? So we're like, well, we're going to do the wedding. So when we came time to that, Brandon Roberts, who sort of tag-teamed into our music on the second time, Brandon, we need a massive EDM mix for the wedding. So we had that. I don't know who thought of the disco droid. I don't know if it's Ari. I don't know if it's Luke. I really don't know the answer. I remember hearing about it and going, I know that I was involved maybe prior to that with, I wanted the paparazzi flashbulbs and the party. I was like, but no, the disco droid, I can't take any credit for that. I don't know where it came from. But I saw it and was like, okay, maybe, but it's really cool. It's really cool.
Well, that's all the time I have for you guys today. Thank you so much. Thank you. Congrats on the season. It was phenomenal. I love this season so much.
Thank you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about Andor Season 2 at slashfilm.com. We have a bunch of articles up about the first three episodes already. I will try to link to a couple of those in the show notes, including Jeremy's review of the full season. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email in the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.